Radio, 90.3 FM.
All Quebecers, we must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Radio with Widget and my man Pro V.
All the way live from University.
Here, Montreal. On CKUT. Nobody doing better, dog.
90.3 FM.
Gone.
CKUT and the place to be from the bottom to the TOP.
This program is uncut. It contains strong language and some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
All the way live radio, CKUT 90.3 FM, every single Wednesday from 3 to 5. This is Pro V. Today's show is going to be an interview that Talib Kweli did on his People's Party podcast with Stretch and Bobbito. If you don't know about Stretch Armstrong and Bobbito, they had a radio show in the 90s that was really influential on hip hop in general, on that decade. In particular, which is a lot of the foundation to what we hear today and what we know as hip-hop. And so throughout the interview, they're going to be talking about the history of being, you know, that influential show. They're going to be talking about how they helped showcase and shape 90s hip-hop. They're going to be talking about how every rapper of the 90s passed through their show from the underground, rappers like MF Doom or Black Star, to the more knowns like the Biggie, Jay-Z, Nas, Busta types. For an example, apparently Nas said that he wrote Illmatic while listening to the Stretch and Bobbito show at home, you know, on top of, you know, obviously appearing on the show, but, you know, it just goes to show what kind of influence that had on the city. If you haven't seen the Stretch and Bobbito documentary Radio That Changed Lives, and you enjoy listening to this show, then you should really take a look at it when you get a chance, you know, when you have time, maybe even take time to go check out some of their old shows on YouTube. Just look up Stretch Armstrong, Bobbito, and you can check out, you know, so many people were taping their shows back in the 90s, so people have uploaded that to YouTube over the years. But yeah, man, enough talking. Just wanted to give you a little background to that. So, without further ado, this is the Talib Kweli People's Party podcast interview with Stretch Armstrong and Bobbito. All the way live radio, CKUT 90.3 FM. This is Pro V. Enjoy. Peace.
These two gentlemen, and that's right, we have two gentlemen on our show today. This is the second time that we've had two people, have been chief inspirations for me when it comes to DJing, when it comes to selecting music, when it comes to having the courage and being brave enough to bring my musical taste to the world, not just for MCing, but also for DJing. These two gentlemen have been instrumental in my development. These men are absolutely foundational to hip hop. They possess keys to understanding this culture. My man Busta Rhymes used to sell tapes of their radio show. He used to call it crack. It'd be like selling crack at school. I don't know why Busta Rhymes would want to sell crack at school, but this is the type of crack he wanted to sell at school. The first time Raekwon the Chef from Wu-Tang Clan ever heard himself on the radio was on their radio show. Biggie Smalls, Jay-Z, both spit historic freestyles on their microphones. Royce da 5'9", Old Dirty Bastard. These are some of the names. Big L, myself, Eminem, Big Pun. These are just some of the names that you've heard first on the radio, on their show. They have always been fierce, fierce advocates for hip-hop culture and have always been passionate gatekeepers for the culture. These two are also artists in their own right. They are creatives. They create music. They create films. One is an author. The other is a filmmaker. Together, they have a new album, No Request. And since we're here, for full disclosure, I'm going to read something here. The reviewer on uprocks.com, and Uprox is our partner on People's Party, wrote, "No Request is both a testament to the legendary duo's curatorial legacy and a building block upon which something entirely new may grow. They've changed so many lives, including my own, in the hip-hop universe. I'm personally honored to have them on my show. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for the legendary Stretch Armstrong and Bobbito Garcia." What's up, y'all?
We are on Thursday, October 22nd. We debut a bi-weekly live radio show titled Stretch and Bobbito Radio on Apple Music Hits. And we also, aside from the album No Request that we released on Uprising Music NYC, this Friday, October 23rd, we release 3 singles off of an upcoming album, which are archival 90s freestyles, which we've created a cappella versions of, and then remastered, re-EQ'd, as well as remixed with elements of our band, the M19s, looped and freaked by Stretch in the studio. And some of the artists that are featured on the first EP off of this upcoming LP titled Freestyle include Big L, Jay-Z Freestyle, the Method Man Ghostface Freestyle, and the Biggie Freestyle, which no one's ever heard in its entirety, not even if you watch the film titled Stretch and Bobbito Radio That Changed Lives.
Why don't you also tell us where we can find that film?
So Stretch and Bobbito Radio That Changed Lives is available at stretchandbobbito.com. That's our home site where you can find out music, you know, about our music, about our upcoming podcasts, about our radio, about press, I mean, you know, merchandise, on and on and on. But I mean, you know, if you don't want to search for our website, just go on Vimeo, iTunes, Amazon, you know, et cetera. Type Stretch and Bobbito, the film will come up. It was on Showtime for 2 years and it was on Netflix for 2 years as well.
I like this new grown and sexy version of Stretch and Bob. Y'all got bands and stuff. And I was, you know, you could find the certain freestyle, certain of the freestyles you could find on YouTube and everything. But, you know, I like to buy music. I don't know how much longer iTunes is going to be around for. I'm excited at the possibility of being able to buy some of those freestyles. You know what I'm saying? I like
that.
No
doubt. Thank you.
Now, what's interesting to me is listening to the NPR show, which you now said you have made a more independent move, and that's definitely aligned with who you guys have been as independent artists throughout your career. It struck me listening to the Dave Chappelle episode, and shout out to Dave Chappelle because I'm out here at Yellow Springs as his guest right now.
Word.
But it struck me when he started cursing, and he said, "Wait, can I curse?" And y'all were like, "Well, yeah, you asked after the fact." And I'm someone who used to listen to Stretch and Bob because you could curse. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's part of the allure of the show, was that you could curse and that you played records with the curses in. And so it's amazing to me that I'm just blessed to have lived a life. I've lived a life that's so beautiful and blessed that I got to hear Stretch and Bobbito be like, hey, with the language. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's amazing to me. So now with this newer iteration of what y'all doing, is it going to be more cursed than on the NPR show?
That's a good question. I think there's going to be a clean as well as a explicit version. I think the live broadcast, because our show is going to be on Thursday nights, keeping with tradition, at 10 p.m., not 1 a.m. It's going to be at 10 p.m. for 2 hours. That's when it's live broadcasted and it's archived. But I believe the live is going to be clean, I think.
Okay.
Not entirely positive. This is all kind of new, and we've just been welcomed to the Apple family, and we're trying to figure out how it all works. But the first show is locked and ready to, well, I shouldn't say that, right? Because it's supposed to be live. They didn't trust us to go live for the first show. with our history.
It was live when you did it.
There you go, Jasmine.
Now, Stretch, the Stretch Armstrong Dog came out, you were about 7 years old. does your name have anything to do with this dog?
Just in, we're both white. That's about it.
Okay. it's interesting you made that point, because actually when I was doing my research for this interview, I went down a rabbit hole of just how the Stretch Armstrong doll even came to be. And part of it was they wanted an Aryan looking doll. That was part of it. Like, so it's interesting that he was like, yeah. yes, that's what we have in common.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely more ethnic than Stretch Armstrong, than the original Stretch Armstrong.
Right.
I've got curly dark hair and I could suntan pretty nicely. But no, I mean, the Stretch Armstrong doll character really wasn't a part of my childhood at all. It just I kind of knew what it was when that name was given to me. I just liked the way it sounded. It sounded like a good radio name.
And I knew
it followed in the tradition of hip hop DJs taking on the names of comic book characters and Superman, like, you know, Clark Kent and Richie Rich et cetera, et cetera.
Now, was your name Yo Adrian at some point, right?
Well, before I got on the radio, I was DJing in clubs maybe for not even a year. And literally, like, every party I did, I just gave myself a new name. Just for
Skinny
fun.
Bones.
Yeah, Skinny Bones. I was actually on the radio as Skinny Bones, but that name was given to me by a legendary writer, Sharp Aaron Goodstone, who I got to know because I believe it was through Stash. My sister knew Stash from downtown, and Stash knew Aaron. Stash knew Sharp, and introduced my older sister to Aaron, and Aaron would come over, and that was like a huge deal for me. I mean, we think about now and how people become stars and these figures that younger people, you know, admire and are impressed by. You know, we didn't have, there was no MTV, there was no internet. So, you know, for me, just the fact that Aaron Sharp was heavy on the Six train. I mean, he had whole cars, was, you know, a prominent writer on the Six, and I lived on between Madison and Park, so that was my train growing up. Like, I would see Sharp, you know, full cars, and then I met Sharp and I was like, oh, yo, I'm a teenager, I'm like, yo, that's Sharp, like, he was a star to me. And then
right,
he ended up calling me Skinny Bones and just went with
that's
it.
That's a very unique New York story.
He's actually on one of our first shows.
Bobito, you came from, like I said, Bobito. Bobito, you came from Westgate Projects, right? And Stretch, your family's from the Upper East Side. Did that ever create any tension between you guys or any weirdness as you guys first got your start?
No, I mean, let me clarify. I was born in Douglas Projects, but where I grew up, Westgate, it wasn't Projects. It was a building that was under Mitchell Lama management. So they had a number of residents that were required to be of low income housing, but it was open to like a very varied financial landscape. So we had like the firemen from the hit show of some, I forgot what's TV network in like 1971. Like lived in our building, and we had like the local city councilman lived in our building. And then we had people, you know, Section 8 welfare living in the building, which was beautiful. I mean, you know, we all loved it. As far as me and Stretch's separate backgrounds, I think I learned more about Stretch growing up on the Upper East Side when we were making our film than when we were, you know, meeting back then and, you know, nerding out on all the amazing hip hop that we both loved. Mm-hmm. It really, you know, I mean, even now, you know, it's, we've known each other 30 years. This is our 30th anniversary of radio broadcasting and a friendship. And like the story he just shared about Sharp, I never knew, you know, the him talking about him juxtaposing his name, Stretch Armstrong, as part of this pantheon of hip hop artists being named after, you know, fictitious characters. I never thought about that back then. I was just like, oh yeah, Stretch Armstrong, the figurine, dope, word, fly. But like, you know, it's like, it, you know, we all need like some space to allow retrospect. But back then, I mean, you know, the genuineness of his friendship and his passion for hip hop is the only thing that mattered to either of us. I mean, and, you know, and same thing for me to him. And, you know, because I went to Wesleyan University and I went to Laura Merriam High School in Pennsylvania as part of an academic scholarship program called A Better Chance, I had befriended other affluent or, you know, well-off people who lived in the Upper East Side. So it wasn't like he was the first person I ever got cool with that was from that zip code, you know, and nor was he the first person from that zip code that I thought, you know, wasn't like stuck in conservative ways and really, you know, open-minded about exploring, you know, my culture, my nationality, my community, as well as this sort of shared hip hop movement as well, which was like separate and connected at the same time. So that's how I would answer your question, which was a great one. You both are like batting 1,000 so far, because like nobody's ever asked Stretch like about the Stretch Armstrong like figurine and how that played into the.
Well, we care. We care here. We care. You know.
Yeah. Y'all doing your research. I love
so,
it.
So, Bob, how do you feel? How was it working with this nerdy Upper East Side white boy? Who went to private school? Did you hold that against him? No, I mean, honestly, for me, Bob really reminded me of a lot of the kids that I grew up with at my school. I mean, yeah, I went to a really progressive, and it's funny when you live, the Manhattan I lived in, Upper East Side, it's really, I lived on 96th Street, the border of Spanish Harlem. You cross the street, you're in Spanish Harlem. You cross the street, you're in the Optimo. And, you know, it's run by all these young Puerto Rican cats who used to call me the N-word lips. That was my nickname when I walked in there. Yeah. I mean, what's more New York than that, right?
I know a white boy that has some nigga lips, too. Oh, sorry. Was I supposed to say N-word lips, too?
No, you can say it, John.
I am. you know, I lived in a building that had a doorman and the building, yeah, my building was pretty much all white, but across the street that changed. And I went to a really progressive school that was founded by, Gus and Marty Trowbridge, two white people that were heavily invested in the civil rights movement. They marched, with Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, they were really prominent, prominent, I won't say prominent, but very impassioned activists. And they founded a school out of that movement. And the whole idea was that there'd be no minority groups in the school, economically, mm-hmm. racially, anything. So it was a very balanced group of kids. There were 18 of us in each class. And you know, and even outside of the class, my father felt it really important that I go to the neighborhoods of my friends. And as a preteen, I was genuinely afraid of going to Harlem because you hear stories, right? I mean, white people really weren't supposed to go to Harlem in the 70s. And my dad would take me up there and drop me off and say bye.
Wow.
I spent weekends in Harlem, you know, going to, whether it was a, you know, we touched on this in the movie, Ivan Rivera, going to church on Sundays. But yeah, going to black churches, Latino churches, mixed churches. I got the full experience and, you know, and then I went to a very white privileged high school where it seemed like even at a high school level, you know, like the four, there'd typically be like four black kids and like two Latino kids. And it was a combination of some of them being very prepared for what was happening academically and some where it felt like this isn't a good fit. Like these kids right here, they're not ready for this. And, And that always kind of rubbed me the wrong way, because you're going to school with kids that, like, they don't feel like they really belong there. And then, of course, you know, I went to college, but that 4 years of high school felt like a real departure from what I was used to in elementary school. And then when I met Bob, it kind of felt like, oh, yeah, like this is like a return to what I grew up with. And it felt, we just had a, you know, aside from the music, aside from the humor, there felt like a real kind of compatibility and a synergy that I really, at that point, was aware of missing from my life for the previous 5 or 6 years, which, you know, when you're 19, 20, that's a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What your father was doing was he was raising an anti-racist baby.
That's
and
right.
I say that because I just bought this book, because both Jasmine and I, for Ibram X. Kendi has this book, Anti-Racist Baby.
I read the adult version.
I need that.
Yeah. Jasmine and I just had newborns, and so does Steve Bramucci.
Congratulations. Amazing.
Thank you. I've been buying children's books.
You know, just earlier today, Bob and I were talking to a friend in Dubai, and I wish that you didn't need to have black friends. You didn't need to have, you know, a gay cousin. You didn't need to have, an immigrant friend of the family to advocate for fairness. I feel like, you know, you see a lot of people like, mm-hmm. oh, you know, I really wasn't down with that whole LGBTQ until my son came out. And now I'm like, I'm riding. It's like,
yeah.
Why wouldn't you just want to be pro fairness right. from day one mm-hmm. as a human being? And not to say that, not to take anything away from the way I was brought up, because I love the way I was brought up, and I take my hat off to, I thank my parents in my heart every day for not being like what we see out there in a lot of people. So I'm sorry, I stepped on what you were about to say.
No, that's perhaps. Exactly where I wanted you to go. Yeah. See, that was what I meant to do. Now, Bob, you spent some time as an intern at Def Jam, right?
Well, let me clarify that. I started out at Def Jam as a messenger making $5 an hour.
Okay.
So I was never an intern there. I was a paid employee, but I was doing intern-like responsibilities in a lot of cases on my own accord and motivation, because between errands, there just wasn't much to do. So I was like, I would hear Andy Tab with a lawyer be like, yo, what sample is this on this Rakim record? Oh, that's James Brown. Bobby Bird, you know, mm-hmm. and he'd be like, who is this kid? You know what I'm saying? Like, I was constantly attacking their senses across the board, you know?
Right.
So I really made the most out of that situation very quickly.
I was going to ask you something that you actually just answered just now, but it leads me to another question.
We do that. Me and Shutch do that. We do what you do.
Yes, yeah, so you already know. But at least you opened up something else when you talked about how you'd be walking by the office and you know the sample. Speak to my audience about how being invested in hip hop and down by law at that time in the culture, because there were mainstream aspects of hip hop culture at this time. You know, you had the Vanilla Ice and MC Hammer and things like that. You know, Run DMC mm-hmm. had the record with Aerosmith, but by and large, hip hop was still an underground culture that was a coded language that you and Stretch were sort of still, learning how to become gatekeepers of. And not gatekeepers in a bad way. It's the second time I said this word, but, Jay-Z talks about later in his career, the need to have cultural gatekeepers to just maintain the integrity of the culture. And I do believe in that.
Sure.
But talk to me about how the plethora of knowledge you gain from being a hip hop fan, from knowing about art, to knowing about music, to knowing about everything, because hip hop is such a beautiful collage of everything that is dope about mainstream culture. You know, that's why hip hop DJs could play any record. Y'all both DJs. Y'all have to know every single genre of music to be a competent mm-hmm. hip hop DJ. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think, part of that, I was subscribed to the tenets that we all love about hip hop, but part mm-hmm. of that I would assign to just the idea that I grew up in New York and I'm born in 1966. So I got to taste the end of this. I mean, not the end, but you know, I got to taste the civil rights movement. I got to taste Black Power movement. I got to taste the explosion of salsa in the 70s. I got to taste And when I say taste, I'm saying like I was in the parks. I was, you know, I got to be a part of playground basketball culture. You know, I am first generation, you know, sneaker culture in its burgeoning stage. You know, like I remember rhyming with Craig Radix before it was recorded and something that could be commodified. Mm-hmm. So I sincerely say that I feel blessed to have lived in the 60s and 70s and been able to, like, you know, grab and experience so many rhythms mm-hmm. of New York life, right? That's just kind of like interwove into itself. And then like break into like 1989, 1990, where it's like all of a sudden now I'm working at Def Jam. Now I'm writing for The Source. Now I'm on radio with Stretch. And all of a sudden it's kind of pivotal because look, I didn't, you know, in retrospect, me and Stretch are titled gatekeepers. But at the time we weren't trying to be gatekeepers, but we were very cognizant that we had to be a vanguard because mm-hmm. we saw Vanilla Ice. We saw MC Hammer. We saw, what happened to breaking, you know, in the mid 80s. And, you know, it was a cautious time, you know, mm-hmm. and it was like, okay, we have our shot to be on the radio. Let's make the most out of it and play the very best artist and music that is available to us. And there was the ecosystem. The Source, before they put TLC on the cover, was like a trusted, I'm just being serious.
Yeah, bars.
It was like a trusted publication yeah. for what the very best that hip hop could be. Me and Stretch on the Radio was like a trusted source for the very, very best of what hip hop could be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there were other, you know, members of the ecosystem that could manipulate what was shared and what was, you know, we like kind of like were mentors or teachers. I mean, in every discipline, you have professors, you have people that have, you know, studied, get masters, you know, in the martial arts, you have like high, you know, level, I don't know what the terminology, but, you know, people need to be mentored. And right now we're in a very open space, which is wonderful because a lot of people can participate, but not everyone is being mentored. And so, you know, we had the opportunity in that era to guide people. And it wasn't just music. It was like, yo, you know, I'm wearing these Adidas Forums in red that I copped in DC on F Street. Like nobody knows the spot, the shop. And like, you know, I could talk about playground basketball in a way on the air that like no one would know about. You know, it's all coded language, you yeah. know. And, you know, people would listen to our cassettes in Germany, in the Black Forest out there and in Tokyo, who didn't even speak English, not even as a second language, didn't speak English at all. And they would somehow decipher not what we were saying, but the emotion that was being put feeling, forth in those yeah. cassettes, and it would affect them. You know, I remember the first time me and Stretch went to Copenhagen, and there was a dude that we met that like barely seen any photos of me. I mean, we were on the radio, you know, mm-hmm. and he was like, yo, like I basically dress like you. I got my hair cut like you. Like, I just want to look like you. This is a dude in Copenhagen that was like,
you were
the
like,
biggest like,
you were like, get off my dick.
No, but I'm just, it was curious to me how influential mm-hmm. we all were to live in that era beyond just the words that were spoken or the beats that were being danced to.
Yeah,
know?
Man. Yeah.
And it was a responsibility, you know, it was a responsibility that you took hold of from your very first verse as an unsigned artist on our radio show. You know, and then to the point where you're like recording and putting out records, it's like, you know, we took all that very seriously. You know, yeah. I still to this day take that mm-hmm. seriously. I'm not on the forefront of trying to, you know, keep the hip hop flag alive mm-hmm. Like I was in the 90s. But, you know, I still care to see that it's alive. And I hope that there are other people who are, you know, active vanguard keepers, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean,
I think I veered off on your question.
No, it's a beautiful answer. I mean, it shaped all of us. And I said at the beginning of this that I'm really, really humbled and honored to be talking to y'all because, again, like you just mentioned, my first appearance on your show was 1995 with Mike and Nine and Tash. You mm-hmm. know, it was, I was a developing MC. I cringe when I listen to that. I'm like, ooh, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, even with...
I'll be honest with you. When you came up, you know, there were a lot of artists who would bring up their homeboys, you know, and sometimes it would be like striking gold, you know, like Fat Joe brought up the Terror Squad. And one of the Terror Squad dudes was Big Dog the Punisher, who 2 years later became Big Pun. Like, wow, we struck gold. Big L brought up Murder Mace and Killer Cam. They became Cameron, you know.
And Jay-Z.
Tash and Mike and I. Yeah. Tash and Mike and I brought up Talib Kweli. I didn't even know how to spell your name. On the cassette, it was Q-U-A-L-I, you know. Right. And it was kind of like, I didn't fall in love with you. And so I liked you as an MC. I was like, okay, he's got good ideas, but like you flourished, you know, by the time you came out as a polished recording artist, you know, it was like, there was a big, big jump. So I hear you, like you could cringe at hearing your first, but you know, like that said, like it was a rite of passage, you know what I'm saying? It was a rite of passage for you and it was a rite of passage for us as well. You know, like we hope that we were providing a space for unsigned artists to express themselves on a weekly basis, you know, because there wasn't another station that was doing that the way that we were with the reach that we had.
Now, as far as, you know, tying it back to the DJ, like Serato has made it easier for someone like me to come in and say, I DJ. You are both you and Stretch are people who could probably still to this day run out immediately, do a whole party with just vinyl, just 45s, all that. Now, you know, I remember running around the city trying to find a Stretch Armstrong party or, you know, and how cool it felt to be in a Stretch Armstrong party at them days. Can y'all tell me, and Stretch, especially you, if you could go first, name some records back then and even to this day that a DJ would have that you as a DJ would be like, ooh, okay, I respect that, you know, especially in this era where you could get everything on Serato and iTunes, but there's still some tunes that that are just on vinyl.
Oh, you want names of songs? Damn.
I mean, you know, give me like two. I don't want you to give up the whole, you know, secret of men, but you know.
Let's see. I mean, it's funny. For Apple, they're encouraging us to play music that can be found on Apple Music. And they have a vast archive that is constantly getting expanded. There's a song by Brothers by Choice called, hold on. Let me get this right. I'm so bad with this. Like, I gotta see records. I just don't remember titles, but,
right. There's a scene in the Radio Change Lives of you going through the crates, going through the records and looking at the spine and knowing just the color and the label and the, you know what I'm saying? So it's definitely a very visual thing.
Right, I would set my records up and they would be, you know, I would know where everything was. Like I could just on instinct, by looking at the spines, looking at the rips, looking at the generic 12-inch sleeves and whatnot. And then usually like I had like in the front of the crate, like I had a stack of new stuff right there that hadn't yet kind of gotten put into where it belongs. And really as a club DJ playing for decades off of vinyl, your crates are like almost like an organism that just evolves over time, right? It's like you think of us like we lose dead cells and then we regenerate cells. That's like how we live. And it's kind of like that with records. Like, okay, these are coming in and those are going out. It's interesting to see which records stay forever and and which don't. It's a trip. I mean, you know, Bob only plays vinyl to this day, and touring the world with Bob for our film, where we would do a screening and in Berlin one on a Saturday and maybe on a Sunday we'd be in Paris and we'd come back to New York, and the following weekend we'd go out. And we left the country like every weekend for several months. It was crazy. We had to be here in New York during the week for various responsibilities. But I have a sizable record collection. I've been buying records since the 80s and hearing Bob spin vinyl and kind of being not reacquainted with, but just reminded how great vinyl sounds. You know, after that, you know, for the, like the last 5 years, any opportunity I can, I play vinyl. I just love it. And it forces a certain type of concentration that leads to, I think, more impactful DJing. Serato, yeah. you can really wing it with Serato if you're tired or if you're not feeling the energy, like right. with records, like you really got to put it together and stay on top of these records, particularly if you're playing 7 inches, which those things come and go. I mean, it's like, it is stressful. If you're tired and you're playing 7 inches, you better get some coffee or something, because those records are relentless. They just, but the record I was thinking of is called Baby, You Really Got Me Going by Brothers by Choice.
Okay.
It's a record I've had for years, but I've re-fallen in love with it. It's not on Apple. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's a funny thing for us to be on Apple and find that balance between playing records that are accessible and ones that aren't, because part of what we've always done is to put you onto things that you either don't know and maybe you can't right. even get unless you check us.
That's right. Now, Bob, you, when you first started, people knew you for the on-air personality, but then you became Cucumber Slice and Cool Bob Love, and you went to DJing at APT, which, and some other parties in New York City, which became some of the classic parties. What made you decide, okay, because I understand now that I've spent a couple of years trying my hand at DJing in public, that is a courageous choice. What made you make this choice?
I mean, you know, similar to becoming a producer in the past, you know, 2 years, where, you know, I think I imagined one day I would become a producer, but I never knew when it was going to actually happen, right? And now me and Stretch are like producers. We have a band, M19s, we put out an album, No Request. You know, we use elements of the band, you know, doing original music to create remixes for Big L and Jay-Z's freestyle. It's like, it's all like uncharted territory for me. And similarly, back in like the 90s, you know, the idea of DJing, where I thought I would one day become a producer, I never thought one day I'd become a DJ. I never thought one day I'd be a radio host. But then I found myself hosting, and, you know, I'm a person who seizes opportunities, and I couldn't help but be inspired. I'm 4 feet away from Stretch. I'm on a mic and Stretch is killing it. He's playing the Beatles and, you know, Tribe Called Quest blends, mashups. You know what you're talking about, right?
Wow. Okay.
No. When you play the Beatles, when you play the Beatles Tribe mashup.
Right, you're talking about
in 1990.
Flying instrumental from Magical Mystery Tour. Yeah. I wasn't playing I wanna hold your hand.
Yeah, no. I mean, you blended it with the Tribe, and it was like I was like bugging out. So, you know, there was always these curveballs that Stretch would do, and then, you know, in terms technically, like, you know, his blends and his cuts. It was, you know, it's like when you're there every single week that close to somebody, mm-hmm. after a while, you're going to just get some level of curiosity. Like, yeah, like I think I want to do that too, you know?
Right.
And not to say, like, you know, there's a lot of people that get curious about MCing that really shouldn't rhyme, you know? And there's people that DJ that really shouldn't DJ.
Yeah.
You know, nice. But I come from a musical family. And I'm a dancer, and I felt like I may not be the best that does this, but I think I have the right to try. And, mm-hmm. you know, at that point, you know, the DJ world wasn't always welcoming, you know, and it wasn't easy to.
That's a good thing, I think.
No, it was a great thing. You know, mm-hmm. It's similar to, like, you know, people making music now as opposed to making music in the 90s. Like, it was a financial commitment to be an unsigned artist making demos in the 90s. You had to pay for studio time. You had to, you know, get your joint mastered if you wanted to press it up independently, then, you know, on and on and on. Same thing with DJing. It's like, if you want to DJ, you got to buy equipment. You got to buy records. You got to be in the shops. You got to be digging.
Yeah.
You know, it was like a huge, huge, huge commitment. So it wasn't easy for just anybody to make that passage.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was in the industry. I was in the community. I was of the culture. And, you know, I felt like I had something to offer that was different. And, you know, I've never, look, my first gig, in a big club in New York was with Rock Raider and Clark Kent and Louis Vega on the bill.
Man.
Like, imagine how much I was itting in my pants,
man.
You know? And then I was DJing eventually on Me and Stretch's show. Imagine that, like the premier hip hop show in the world. And I'm behind the turntables and I don't even have two turntables in my crib.
You on the turntables? The turntables?
I was on the turntables.
You said that twice.
I didn't have two turntables. I didn't even have two in my crib.
Were you nervous that I was listening?
Yeah, that was SHITTING. You know, like imagine who's listening, you know. But eventually I got past that. And, you know, I want to be an okay DJ. And I want to, and you know, you're right. I want to do some mythical parties. APT, me and Spinner collaborated on Stevie Wonder tribute parties.
Oh, man. Me
and Stretch wound up doing our anniversary parties. The one at Le Poisson Rouge in 2010 is like, mm-hmm. it's mythical at this point. It's like mm-hmm. people who weren't there, like talk about it as if it almost didn't happen.
Yes, that's right.
You know, and me and Rich's parties, you know, worldwide with our collaboration. And, you know, I can go on and on about, you know, phenomenal parties that I've done. And it's a blessing, you know, and I'm still learning. I'm still mesmerized by Stretch as a DJ. I'm still mesmerized by Rich, Medina, right. Spinner, you know, still, I don't get nervous like I used to, but there's still a part of me that's like, wow, I'm DJing with Stretch. Oh my God, I'm DJing with Clark Kent. Right. You know, like got a DJ with this dude looking at me like, you know, but you know, luckily they're friends and they're encouraging and you know, we all have fun.
Absolutely. Now, you talked a lot about moving into the production space. A great part of the movie, Radio Changed Lives, is when Nas realizes that he was rapping on one of Stretch's beats. Stretch, you did tracks for Capone and Noriega, Tragedy, a lot of Queens rappers. First track of Lil' Kim's debut, Big Mama Thing, features a verse by Jay-Z. Now, I've heard a story about this Kim verse was maybe dissing Tupac and Faith Evans or something like that, and... Mm-hmm. And can you tell me about this? Because I only heard bits and pieces of the story.
Yeah, so it's great that you're asking me this question in 2020, because there was a full circle moment recently. But yeah, basically, you know, I think I had what it took on the musical side, on the idea side, on the technical side, to be a producer. When I say producer, I mean like a beat maker. Mm-hmm. I just didn't have the gusto, the self-confidence. I rarely really liked what I did. And then, you know, I was just, you know, bumping elbows with like the best producers in the world. Like, mm-hmm. you know, beat miners, Q-Tip, Pete Rock, Large Professor, you know, Beat Nuts, like
right.
these are my boys. I'm like, what am I doing? And of course, looking back, that was the wrong attitude to have, right? Because mm-hmm. they were actually all the aforementioned producers who heard what I was doing were incredibly supportive. But I also had a lot of other interests, and I just never really devoted the time to really nurture that part of my career. But I did come up with this beat that to me like said Lil' Kim all over it, and. Mm-hmm. You know, that the production label deal game back then was funny, as you probably know. You know, a lot of people were getting deals and they wanted to control the budgets so that they can, you know, double dip and take credit and all that. And Craig Kalman, who was the president of Atlantic, now he's the chairman. He and I worked for him when Big Beat was his independent label back in 89. I played him that track and he's like, oh, this is Sylvester loop with the drums over. It's perfect for Kim. Let me play it for Lance on Rivera.
Right.
And I knew Lance. I knew Jacob York, like, but they weren't trying to have it.
Not to cut you off, but we had 88 Keys on, and he told a story about how Craig Kalman would call him and explain and tell him which loops, which records he wanted him to loop. So it's funny that you said that he knew the loop. Like, that's what he was on, I guess.
Yeah. So Craig loved it, but, you know, the people in control of the record really weren't, they weren't trying to have me be down because I wasn't part of their clique. And and Craig really, to his credit, he really pushed for it. We recorded it at Daddy's house. Actually, I laid the beat down at Chung King, and actually Lord Finesse came down. He hung out. You know, Finesse is an absolute master on the sampler and the boards. So he was kind of giving me encouragement and a little bit of feedback. And then the vocals were recorded at Daddy's house. That's where Lil' Kim came in to record. And Biggie was there. And Biggie was, you know, amazing. He was hilarious. He was funny. One session, Clark Kent was there, and the three of us were just, it was insane. Clark Kent is my DJ idol. He's like, yes. he's family now, and we were super cool back then. But in that moment, I was like, this is crazy. Mm-hmm. I'm here in the studio with Biggie and Clark Kent, and we're just having a great time while Kim was doing her vocals. Kim would not acknowledge me at all. Like, no hello, no, like, oh, that's the producer. She may have thought I was an intern at the studio, maybe an engineer, maybe I was a journalist. I don't even think she knew what I was doing there. She may not have even known that I made the beat.
Right.
So it was recorded. Her second verse, yeah, she's dissing Faith, dissing Tupac. Now, Craig needed Puffy to be cool with the record because they needed Biggie to be a part of all of the entertainment projects. So Puffy would have to sign off on that. Puffy had to be happy. And he got the demo. He was like, Kim dissing Faith, dissing Tupac? Nah, that's just not even possible. And then I don't even know how the idea to have Jay-Z do the middle verse happened, but it may have been around the same time that High School High soundtrack was being done. I think Jay was somehow involved in that. I'm not sure.
Good soundtrack.
But
my movie.
Shit movie, good soundtrack.
It was a good movie.
But I never saw it. But they got Jay-Z to do the middle verse. They paid him $10,000, which at the time to me seemed like a lot of paper. And his verse ended up being 2 or 4 bars shorter than Kim's. And I mixed the record, but I didn't know at the same time that Jacob York had another mix of the record. And they didn't edit out the blank 4 bars. And that's why you hear, after Jay-Z's verse, just empty music before the chorus comes in.
Wow.
My version was fly. My version obviously did not have those empty bars. And it also had Lord Finesse and I mixed it. So they're like, there were lots of delays and just, you know.
You should drop that for the people one day.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of like, you know, just mutes and just creative. And the record that came out was just a straight pass. But I always thought it was kind of funny that Kim just was like, kind of like a sourpuss. Like, she just wasn't gracious, wasn't cool. Mm-hmm. At the time, looking back, I understand, like, she was probably going through a lot of stress. She probably wasn't out of the hood yet. Like, she was, mm-hmm. she had her own set of issues that I may have been unaware of. I was looking at this, yeah. like, through my own experience mm-hmm. without considering what her life might have been like. So fast forward to last year, the Loud Experience at Radio City. I don't know if you know about what went down there, but
no, I don't.
But yes, so Sean C. basically executive produced a Loud Records sort of reunion showcase,
okay.
and it was at Radio City, and it was incredible. The atmosphere in Radio City was nothing but joy and love. And you're talking about, like, every person you know from the industry that cared about the music was there. Like, every intern, every publicist, every A&R person that was really about it. For me, as someone who's, you know, occupied, you know, a certain space in this culture, I was just walking around saying hi to people, and I was getting name checked constantly. I mean, like the amount of love that I experienced in that room. Bob, you were out of town. You missed it. They actually wanted me and Bob to host the thing, but I didn't want to do it without Bob, so we didn't do it. Bob, you would have had the best time ever. It was incredible. At one point, exhibits on stage. Now I have like all access credentials. So I walk up straight down those carpeted paths to the front of the stage, and there's a little VIP area in the front where they've got the usher standing there. And people are like, yo, Stretch! Stretch, what up? Stretch, yo! Exhibits on stage, music is pumping, and I show the credential to the woman. She's like, nah, that doesn't work here. You can't come in here. I was like, word? And exactly at that moment, Exhibit goes, Stretch Armstrong, I see you, motherfucker! Yeah! Like, he just beats me up crazy, and the whole place like, ah! Exhibit impersonation. And I'm standing there like, I'm like, that's me! Anyway, and she's like, that's cool, but you can't come in here.
No!
I was like, I'm good! Anyway, and ended up being on stage and just standing next to Pete Rock and watching the whole thing. But it was incredible. Little Kim came out to do Quiet Storm, right? Uh-huh. And it's crazy because of everyone that participated in this night, Kim and Fat Joe were really like celebrities amongst celebrities. Mm-hmm. Like they really, like people were like, oh, you know, like following them around. It's just, it was crazy. Like they really like, you know, there were incredible artists. I mean, Wu-Tang was there, but Joe and Kim, people were just like obsessed with them that night. So Kim came out with the Mob. Mob did it 90s style. They were out there with like, I think they had three or four buses come from QB.
Right.
And they had 40 people on stage with them. It was like nothing has changed. And then Kim came out, the place erupted. And then afterwards, Kim, who had a bodyguard, kind of, she left the stage and sat down, and they were like, the bodyguard was like telling, even like a lot of the dudes from QB, like, chill, like, just let Kim just take her seat. And she was really near me. I was like, all right, this is my chance. This is my chance to address what happened in the studio.
I'm going to address
it.
Years ago. And I was like, this could be an amazing moment, or this could go really south, like hard. Yes. So I went up to Kim. She was sitting in that chair. I got down on my knee and I was right next to her. I said, Kim, hi, do you know who I am? She's like, you look familiar, but I don't. I'm sorry. She was very sweet. I was like, I'm Stretch Armstrong. She's like, oh, hi, how you doing? I was like, yeah, I don't know if you remember, but I produced Big Mama Thing. She's like, yeah, of course. I was like, yeah, well. Yeah, so, you know, I just, you know, you weren't very nice to me back then.
What'd she say?
She was like, I'm so sorry. I was like, it's all good. I know you were going through whatever, but it's great to you know, put that behind us and see you. And
yeah. Just
congratulations on you know, your decades of success, and it's great to see you. And she gave me a hug and a kiss, and we just chilled.
That's beautiful. That's
oh my God, I love it.
So, it was like the moment was a little more Larry David than I'm conveying. It was like, yeah, you weren't that nice to me. I just want to put that out there. Shout out to Kim.
Yes, definitely.
Shout out Lil' Kim. She was one of my favorite guests. I can't even imagine that she didn't speak to you back then, because not only was she so open during the interview, she actually watched one of my karaoke performances of her song. So double shout out to Lil' Kim. Love her for life. You've worked with a lot of crazy big names. What made you decide that producing tracks for rappers wasn't the avenue that you wanted to go down?
I mean, I think I kind of addressed that already. I just wasn't, the process wasn't rewarding for me. I mean, I've always been really comfortable DJing. And even when I got the opportunity to be on the radio, I think there was a part of me that didn't feel like a young white man could properly represent this culture through his voice. I never questioned my taste in music and my musical judgment. Like, I was 120,000% confident in assessing what I felt was music that should be championed and advocated for. But being in New York City, talking on the radio, like that didn't feel like something I wanted to do for the reason I just mentioned. But it's also because I just didn't have that kind of comfort doing that kind of thing. It was uncomfortable for me. And through the encouragement of even like Funkmaster Flex, who was like one of the first people that was telling me, like, you should talk as a DJ. You're not going to get the recognition that you deserve if you don't talk. And even Bob, like, you know, it just became a thing that I eventually became comfortable with. But similarly, I've never wanted to do things that didn't feel comfortable to me. And the whole process of making beats, just there was always something about it that I think was really just because I didn't love what I was doing. And, mm-hmm. and I liked other people's stuff more. You know, I had a few glory moments where I'd play beats the Nas example, that was an incredible moment for me. It didn't lead to me making more tracks. It was like, maybe that was enough. Like Nas loved your beat. Amazing. There's something very kind of pure. Stretch. Huh?
Let me interject, because interestingly enough, right, that's where we left off, or that's where you left off in the 90s, but it's 2020 and your hip hop producer hat is completely back on.
I was going to go there.
Okay, good. I want to make sure that you're not stuck in the past.
Yeah, so
that's a true friendship right there.
But then when I did Big Mama Thing, and that became, you know, that was bootlegged by whoever was supplying all the bootlegs to Rock and Soul and other 12-inch shops. That was like a street hit, Big Mama Thing. Like that was out there. And when that happened, I remember Damon Dash and Jay-Z hitting me up like, "Yo, what's up? What do you got?" And that was the moment, right? You got to take these opportunities when they present themselves. And that was simultaneously the time when the first time when just everything about hip hop in that moment was starting to feel like a chore to me. And you know, when the industry started really becoming an industry, you know how it was. Like when there was no money in it, people were in it for the beats, for the rhymes, for the girls, for the parties, for the clubs, for a little bit of money. But once it became real money, who started, you know, really trying to get that money? It was like people that were, you know, hustlers. They went from the street to the hip hop industry. And that was one element. It was also, you know, people that weren't a part of the culture trying to dictate where the culture went. And these are the kinds of people now I found myself having to kind of like interact with. And I think I was maybe, you know, because what Bob and I were doing on the radio for so many years was such a, like a pure oasis, doing something that involved having to interface with people that didn't have the same intentions that we had. It just felt laborious to me. It just felt like it just wasn't appealing. And I think, you know, that might be a really naive perspective, but I think that's what was going on. Anyway, yeah, like to what Bob said, like, you know, we've got our band M19s and you know, I had this idea to isolate the acapellas from these recordings and remix them. And, you know, when I brought that to Bob, I was like, that's incredible. Can we do it? And I was like, I don't know if we can do it. I know the technology is there to isolate.
We have the technology.
We have the technology, but I know that I knew that we need to be working from uncompressed audio. And I know anything that's recorded over the FM sound waves is going to be compressed. So how much separation are we going to get? How much artifact noise are we going to get? Shout out to the artifacts. That really
we played some
to
artifacts
be seen.
Records on that went right after Earthquake was rapping. Yeah.
And, so I got the acapellas. We had a Joe Run Bombay in Halifax prepare the audio because he's like this technical demon. He's incredible and technical wizard, not a demon. And I got the raw acapella tracks and I listened to them. I was like, wow, these sound horrible. like without a beat over them. They just sound, there's just like phasing, there's like EQ changes, there's levels that are going all over the place. Like, this is going to take a lot of surgery. And the first thing I did was I just started taking some instrumentals from great 90s tracks and put them underneath these acapellas. And within 30 seconds, I knew that it was going to work. Like, as soon as the beat went over the acapellas, it was like, oh, all the transient issues, the places where there's artifact noise, that all gets disguised when drums go on top of the tracks. And I sent Bob a little 30-second snippet of Jay-Z and Big L rhyming over this, and he was like, what? So, and then I was like, okay, now I got to really, I haven't sampled tracks and sequenced beats since the 90s. Let's see what happens here.
Yeah.
And I'm a much more confident person now. I think I'm musically much more sophisticated. And of course, we've got, you know, decades of music that's influenced us. I mean, just my mental space is just such a different, it's in such a different place than I was in, you know, 1995, 1996. Yeah. And I'm really pleased with what we created. We can't wait to share it with the world. I think the stuff's available now as we speak.
Yeah.
So to even it out, you know, not only did we grab the acapella versions of Big L, Jay-Z, Method Man, Ghostface, and Biggie from our 90s archive, but we also have Nas's Freestyle, Big Pun and Fat Joe, Mobb Deep, Mad Skills with Q-Tip, OC with Pharrell Monch and Lars Professor doing it on SP. I mean, on and on and on. So think about the very, you know, like highest level live moments in our radio history, you know, that were featured in our film.